Yes, hello, folks. Welcome to the weekly Manchester United podcast. I'm your host, as always, Phil Barnes, joined with my regular co-host, the excellent James Rhodes from United Muppeteers, on this Wednesday morning. It's a day earlier on our weekly podcast, and next week we'll be moving it to Monday. So hopefully that's something that's good news to you all. James, first of all, how are you doing, my friend?
Good. All right. And you?
Yeah, I'm actually better than what I thought it would be. If you told me on Friday that you needed to lose the next two games, I was probably would have wanted to throw myself off a roof. And I don't know why I've discovered a new me that's not so negative, because I never usually need a reason to be negative.
I'm rubbing off on you, Phil. You spend too much time with me.
Yeah, I don't know. and I can manage this main headspace without drugs, which is pretty incredible. Obviously, the aftermath of the 3-2 Galatasaray result, and of course, the disappointing result against Palace United, losing both of those for different reasons. Much primarily what we'll focus on here, and we'll talk about some other things going on inside the club. We'll talk a little bit about the ownership and some of the news that's come out over the last few days on that. A couple of other tidbits. First of all, man, like I said, we'll focus on last night, a game that had everything. They'd had positives, negatives, insanity. We'll focus on some of the things that went wrong. Then, of course, we'll talk about some of the positives with Rasmus Højlund, who probably is the only reason why I don't want to throw myself off a roof. It was a game that United really needed to win. And once again, remarkable individual mistakes are the reason why United have not won this game. Mistakes that you really shouldn't see at this level. And there's lots of them. I mean, Bruno Fernandes, I thought, should have scored in the first few minutes. I thought he had a really poor game last night.
Mm-hmm.
The Marcus Rashford decision to square a ball is typical of a striker that's not in form. This is the types of things that strikers, when they have no confidence, do.
Yep.
But same season last season, Marcus Rashford puts it in the bottom corner. You can sense the feedback loop with his lack of confidence, the anxiety on the sideline. And you can see the impact it's having on Rashford. We'll talk with him too. And of course, Andre Onana, who's had an absolute nightmare. I'm not one of these people that is paying for David De Gea, forgetting about what David De Gea did against Sevilla in his last European game.
Many games. I mean, since he spilled that ball against Chelsea in the chase for top four under Ole during the interim period, he's had mistake after mistake in key games. So
yeah, I remember
there's
Barcelona.
No reason to look into the past for David De Gea.
I know. Errors. But we knew this would happen, right? So anyway, we'll talk about him. But anyway, give me your thoughts on last night.
Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate. It is, because if you look at it, you know, I'm not expecting them to light the world on fire. But when you look at last night's game, similar to Palace at the weekend, I know there's injuries. I know there's all of that. But it's not that weak a team that's starting out there. When you look at it, I think there's arguably three players in rotation there. Amrabat at left back. Obviously, the main standout there is not having any left back of who's actually a left back at all. That one, sure. But, you know, at center back, you only really have one center back out with it, which is Lisandro Martinez. It was a choice to play Lindelof instead of Maguire the last two games. And I think he's been extremely poor, Victor Lindelof, this season so far. And in the last two games, I think he was pretty terrible. When Maguire had a really good performance against Crystal Palace in the cup game, I was surprised to see him not get one of these starts. You have in the midfield pretty much all your first choice players available. Obviously, you're having Bruno play on the right, as you don't have wingers back. Antony coming on as a sub after returning from his absence. It's only three rotations. You have to be able to beat teams like Galatasaray with three rotations. And not to be too negative about this, but if you look at the Turkish league right now, Galatasaray are not on top of it. Fenerbahce are with one Frederico Paulo dos Santos playing in the midfield in an undefeated. And so when you look at this, you're seeing this is not a team that United should be struggling with. This is not a team that United should be having this kind of difficulty with. In the first half, I think they played very well, United overall. I think it was a really poor error, really poor individual defending on Zaha by Dalo, and you knew Zaha would be up for it for getting a moment at Old Trafford to do that. You have to pay attention to that. You have to really focus on that. A really poor moment that resulted in the first goal. But otherwise, it was actually a good performance overall in the first half. There was a bit of rushing from a few players, namely Bruno Fernandes and Casemiro. But the chances were coming. There was a lot of sustained attacks. There was a lot of chances being created. There was a lot of moments. Rashford was, you know, I think he does lack confidence, but there was a few things we were doing differently that I've been hoping and asking for, which was Amrabat was offering a lot more support, playing like an actual left back, making the overlapping runs for him, Mount making those runs in through, you know, doing the actual combination plays on the wings that were resulting in crosses, things like that, low crosses, all of that. I thought we were making chances and doing quite well. And one of the things that really surprised me is the change at halftime for Christian Eriksen. One of the biggest issues that we've had this season as a whole is there's a certain goal that we've conceded, I think, 7 or 8 times already this year, and it's basic football. It's someone getting down the wing and cutting it back to midfielder, and they put it into the goal. And there's nothing the keeper can do about that at that point in time. They've got an open shot. It's not being defended. Every time Christian Eriksen plays, this goal happens. Every single time, dating back even to last year when he returned from injury. It's hard because you look at he came on, and Ten Hag just said it, he came on for passing. And we did create more chances. But at the same time, immediately Casemiro's left exposed. And you have a side that has Amrabat, Lindelof, and Eriksen in it defensively, which is anybody will exploit that. And so they did at the end of the day. And I was surprised by it, and it worried. That's actually the part that worries me more than anything, because I think it was antipathetic to the style that you would expect Erik ten Hag to want to put into place. Because when Eriksen came on, we created more chances, but it was a lot more of the direct, over-the-top, long balls in behind type of football that we've been seemingly moving away from. And it's hard because I looked at it and I thought he is actually putting in a good performance from a passing perspective, creating chances and doing all that. And it led to one of the goals. But at the same time, it's one of those things like a revert back to type where instead of controlling the game a bit more, sustaining possession in their half, we went back to basketball, up and down, up and down, up and down, where we create more chances and get a lot of opportunities, but we also end up being far more open at the back. And I was surprised by that. It worries me a little bit. I've seen games where we've been performing really poorly that we've never made changes that early. And I was actually pretty happy with the first half, so I was surprised to see it. And that's my takeaway up right up until the just massive errors that got Casemiro the red card. It was really the second goal that bothered me so much, the second goal we conceded, because it was a direct result of, once again, you know, changing the way that we play that allowed us to be so much more open and exposed at the back. And everything else was down to individual errors, frankly. That was the only one that I really was kind of frustrated with as a team.
So I'm going to slightly defend Ten Hag here. If he doesn't make attacking changes and United don't win that game, he's going to get slaughtered, right? It's a game United needed to win. So you bring Eriksen on, you gain something, you lose something. You obviously lose something defensively, you gain something offensively. For me, the second goal was more Casemiro's fault, in my opinion. Casemiro was the closest to the player. Casemiro's got his eyes on him for quite a while and still makes no major effort to get back. And I've seen this a lot. He is the defensive midfielder. It's his job to primarily track the most offensive midfield runner. Your job is to make sure you get back. And I've seen this a number of times, like you said, where teams are exploding United in that area. We've seen this with Odegaard. I've seen many, many times players get to the byline, pull the ball back. I saw it against Burnley. Jay Rodriguez was doing it quite a bit. You saw it with Brighton. And I think one of the things they would get with Mabry is a lot of pressing. You'd get that defensive cover, but you might not get the quality going forward. I also think sometimes you can get a defensive midfielder and play them as a fullback. You saw Pep Guardiola do the opposite. Bayern Munich fullbacks turning defensive midfielders, what have you. But Amrabat, for the second goal, United had a warning right before that that they didn't
hit. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He's exploded down the left because of a couple of things. One, he doesn't know how to sense danger in the same way someone that plays there every week does. Yep. So they're good on the ball, you know, they have obviously football IQ, but there's subtle things that they don't pick up on, that defenders pick up on. Spatial awareness, you know, how to anticipate, where's my foot, where's my winger, you know, I'm in space where if he picks that ball up, I'm either showing him wide, I'm not showing him inside, you know, I'm not mentally drifting. When you are played your whole career in a different position, instinct sometimes takes over and you start drifting into positions that get you caught out. He was, in my opinion, responsible for the goal against Crystal Palace for the same reason.
Because, yeah, absolutely.
The inexperience of being a left back and knowing that Jordan Ayew's playing for free kicks, right?
Yeah.
Knowing when to tackle, when not to. Not saying it's his fault because he's being played in a position that's not his best position. Also, this is a guy that, you know, wasn't 100% fit when he came in, got thrown into this. If you remember Burnley, he gave a free kick away in the 93rd minute in a bottom left-hand corner. Right.
Yeah.
He's repeatedly shown, with the exception of Crystal Palace Carabao Cup, that this is not a position he can really play.
Yep.
If you look at the third goal, he is the one that plays Icardi onside from sitting far too deep. Varane still should anticipate this better, in my opinion. And I was kind of concerned how easy it was done for Pace. But, and the first goal, Dalot needs to deal with the ball before it bounces, first of all.
Yeah,
I also think Onana could help him a little more. I think Onana could also have come out a little more and closed the angle down for Zaha. I don't know why he stays on his line. For the Icardi goal, I have no idea why Onana doesn't come out and close the angle down and also goes to ground so easily, where he makes Icardi's mind up for him. So I think not having a left back, I'm not saying it's an excuse. Of course, United should be doing better, is a major, major problem. You go back to the Arsenal, the Emirates, you know, better team than Galatasaray, away.
Oh, yeah.
96 minutes, that game's one each. United easily could have won. Yep. They had a, yep. They had Dalot, they had fullbacks in playing in that game, the regular one playing in that game. Or I think he came on a sub, didn't he? So they had fullbacks in that game, right? And you saw a much better... you saw a much better Manchester United. But
yeah,
I think out of all the defenders United can't lose, the two most important are Wan-Bissaka and Martinez, because they don't have anything that's similar to them where they can play. Lisandro Martinez is a left-footed centre-back. Prior to United sending Lisandro Martinez, they were conceding horrendous goals constantly. They get a left-footed centre-back in, they start getting the best out of Wan-Bissaka, and they've got the best defensive home record in the league. Now you're trying to bet a goalkeeper in, and when United are not playing well, being a goalkeeper is a very, very lonely position. Very, very difficult. Onana will be going through something he's never gone through in his career. The scrutiny, the criticism, and you're playing in a team that has no left back. Where it's, they've been exposed against Palace and Galatasaray for not having a left back, in my opinion. Of the defenders starting, Ten Hag didn't sign any of them.
Right? Yeah.
He didn't sign Dalot. He didn't sign Varane. He didn't sign Lindelof. Right. And, you know, so this is not his defense. And I don't think any of them would be there if he could buy alternatives. Now, that's, again, you know, an ideal world. Most managers have to deal with that. So what is his back four comprised of? A right back, Dulles overplayed, right, because they have no other option. He's not United's first choice right back. A non-fit centre back. Another centre back that, in beside Martinez, I think is a decent defender. He's a third choice centre back. And Lindelof, he has been poor, but, you know, and then he's got no left back. I think that's very difficult for any manager.
Yeah.
Then, of course, you know, Onana's mistakes and all that there, you know, it doesn't help. So it's difficult for Ten Hag to do anything about players making individual errors. Rashford not taking that chance, should be taking that. So I think in his slight defence with Eriksen, he had to take risks. A 2-1, United should have gone on and won that game 3-4-1. Easily. They're in control. They've 11 players on the pitch. Crystal Palace, when they scored against United, stayed organised, kept it tight, and made sure they did the basics. That's all you've got to do, right?
Yeah.
Why can't United close the game? Why can't they sit there, keep it tight, stay organised, stay in shape, and do the basics?
But yeah, and the thing is, there is that part of it is less of a critique and more of a concern, because the issue I have with it is that, given all of those issues in the defense, the last thing I'd be doing is opening up my midfield by sticking Eriksen in there,
yeah,
to try and force a goal, you know. And I think that part of the problem is the situation that Ten Hag has now is, for whatever reason, he did not trust that Marcus Rashford, Rasmus Højlund, Bruno Fernandes, Mason Mount would get another goal, with Hannibal in there too. He did not trust that that five was going to get a goal. And I think he has to. I think he has to trust them. It's a tough situation, but when you look at it from the outside, you know, this is part of the problem with being pressed for results because of everything that's gone on, is it becomes a dwindling spiral and it gets worse and worse and worse because you get under more and more pressure. You kind of have to trust those five and say, I'm not going to weaken my defending to try and force another goal in here. Not at halftime, maybe at 70 or 80 minutes when I have no choice, but not at halftime.
Have they earned that trust, though, James? I mean, prior to this, Rasmus Højlund hasn't scored a Premier League
I know, but you have to. I feel like either way, you have to. When you watch the first half, should they have scored more goals? Is, I guess, the question I would ask to you. In my opinion, it's yes. Like you said, Bruno should have scored that goal. Mason Mount gets a shot near halftime that Hannibal thinks is going near post, so he jumps the other way, ends up blocking the shot himself accidentally, right? Because Mason Mount goes far post instead.
Yeah.
Three or four chances in that first half created by that same team. If they make those three or four chances in the second half, they're probably getting a goal.
But if you look at United, this is one of their problems, is that they start well and fade badly second half.
I know.
Right? So they never capable of sustaining momentum.
I know.
I totally get what you're saying, right? Because you could steal them on an argument for both, right?
Yeah.
With Ten Hag, you know, I think he had to take risks to try to win that game, because drawing it would not have, you know, he still would have been heavily criticized. And I think part of the reason, I mean, I've asked people that work in football, that are exceptionally well educated, that know a lot more about the game than me, that what do they see wrong? Like, some people have said to me, you know, they're not set up right defensively. I don't know exactly what that means. but I think for Ten Hag, look, he has to get results, right? This is regardless of the injury situation at Manchester United. You can't lose, you know, five games out of six, seven games out of ten. You can't. And here's the thing, James, right? If you look at United, go back to Sevilla last season, you can almost trace everything and United's collapse into conceding horrendous goals from the Lisandro Martinez injury. Yeah. Once Martinez came off in that game, United fell apart. Fell apart second half. And I remember saying in the Sevilla game away from home that if Lisandro Martinez is on the pitch, United don't concede those goals, right? I believe if Luke Shaw, Wan-Bissaka, Lisandro Martinez is on that pitch, United don't concede the goals they conceded last night. I don't believe Wan-Bissaka concedes the first one. I don't believe Luke Shaw is exposed for the left-back position. And I don't believe that United would be so porous down the middle, right?
Yep.
That doesn't matter. They're not there. You've got to deal with their absence, right? United's unfortunate situation with injuries is a lot of them are in the same part of the field. And if you look at the goal against Forest, for example, a goal that should never be conceded at this level. You look at the goals against Besiktas here, away from home, another Turkish team, goals that should never be conceded in that level, at this level. RB Leipzig that year, same thing. This is a repeated issue.
Yeah.
Right? No matter who the centre backs are. So I think that for United, they have a problem at centre back. They have to invest heavily in centre backs.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
They have to do. Right, that is a part of the problem, of course. I think Varane needs to be moved on at the end of the season.
Yep. And, or at least he has to be the rotation, not the starter.
Yeah. James, last night, and maybe it's because he's not fit, but watching that Icardi goal, I don't want him to be disrespectful here, but I was thinking Varane should be playing for Galatasaray, not United.
Yeah.
This is where a player at his stage of his career should be. Right, you know, great player at one point, on the decline, you can go play there. You know, it's a really bad result, and Ten Hag is in a position where he's never been in his career, where he has a crisis on his hands, a legitimate crisis. My opinion is this: United need to back him, because every time this happens, they fold and sack the manager. And if when Chelsea sacked Graham Potter, I said they have to know why he failed before you appoint somebody else. You can't just say results aren't good enough, you're sacked, or you learn nothing. You don't even know how to appoint someone to fix the problems that you have. You have to be capable of sitting down and saying, these are the football reasons why you failed, right?
Yeah.
And know exactly why they failed. I don't think United know the answer to that question beyond their injuries. Right. Or maybe they do, but they don't have the will to change them. So
I'm not sure they want to know, to be honest.
Well, but for me, if they're going to sack Ten Hag, I don't want to tell me it's because his results aren't good enough. I want to tell you why he failed.
Yeah. You're right. You're totally right, because that is correct. It results are the, I mean, it's in the word, it's a result. It's what happens at the end of a process. Mm-hmm. You've got to know what's wrong with the process that leads to a result. You know, and just to back up on that final point, you know, the kind of the argument that I'm making where I worry that it's going to get worse for Ten Hag, because I'm not sure. This is where I think, as a manager, his lack of experience in playing in a league that is as tough as the Premier League, and with the pressures of United, comes into play here. This is an interesting example, but I was talking to someone, you know, at 2-2, with a red card down to 10 men. If that's Jose Mourinho or Ole Gunnar Solskjaer on the sideline, they're throwing on extra defenders. They're throwing on Scott McTominay, and they're walking out of Old Trafford with a point, guaranteed. They're going to make sure that happens. Ten Hag goes the other way, and we end up conceding an extra goal. But I want to just add to that initial point. You know, last week, in my view of a bit of what's going wrong, you take that Burnley game, right? Huge rotation. But what did they have? That midfield was Casemiro, McTominay, and Hannibal Mejbri. Keep a clean sheet. No goals conceded. 1-0. He trusted Marcus Rashford, Rasmus Højlund, and Bruno Fernandes to get a goal, and they got one. You go into Crystal Palace midweek. You're starting in that game. You're starting in that game in the midfield once again. Hannibal Mejbri, Casemiro, and Mason Mount. There's a similarity here. A lot of running, a lot of legs, a lot of energy. You still have Amrabat at left back. You've got Harry Maguire, very short on confidence at center back. And if up front, you've got Facundo Pellistri, Anthony Martial, and Garnacho. These are not three players who have an experienced track record of goal scoring, you know, outside of Martial, who hasn't been fit in 2.5 years. But they go and win 3-0. Keep a clean sheet, grind a result out, and they get the win. And then you take the Crystal Palace game, you make a change, which is, you know, not a bad change to hear. You would think that this would work in the midfield, Casemiro, Mason Mount, Bruno Fernandes, but you don't keep it. against Galatasaray, I see kind of the same issues as before. I think most of us would be happy with that Burnley result every game right now, while we're dealing with an injury crisis, while we're dealing with a, what would you call it? While you're dealing with the problems that we're dealing with at the moment. And I think there's a level of pragmatism that Erik ten Hag needs to take at the moment, because you cannot force it at this level of play. I think it is a bit of a lack of experience from him to try and force the win when you could grind out results. You know, one thing, you know, I credit in Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's second season, he had a run like this, right? To start the year was actually pretty bad. And we end up losing 6-1 to Tottenham right before the international break, the first international break, right? Just a horrible result. And he went back to Fred and Scott in his midfield after that international break. By January, we were, I believe, at or around the top of the table, you know? And I don't think anybody thought we were going to win the title that year. But it was impressive. It was an impressive turnaround that came from grinding out results. And Sir Alex Ferguson's done the same thing. And my concern is if it denotes to me, you can't, I guess the part of the problem is that the forwards haven't earned the trust from Erik ten Hag, but you kind of have to give it to him anyway.
But think about this, ask you a question.
Yeah.
When was the last time a striker outside of Marcus Rashford scored in the Premier League?
Yeah, it's been a long time, hasn't it? Yeah, it's
prior
been a
to
long
that,
time.
We're going back to Ronaldo.
Yeah.
Okay.
I know.
That's a
I
fucking know. Disgrace. Right?
I know.
So when you're talking about trusting players, trust yeah. who? You know.
Well, I
mean,
hear you.
Literally,
I hear you.
So here's the thing, right? So
yeah.
when you look at Mourinho's team, Solskjaer's team, you know. They were set up differently. They were set up low block, yeah. defend, counter attack,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Rashford was essentially a left midfielder, right?
Yeah.
Mourinho wanted him defending before he wanted him attacking, right? And I understand there's a certain pragmatism about that. But the reasons why United conceding goals are basic issues, right? Not mm-hmm. defending set pieces properly, mm-hmm. giving free kicks away in stupid positions of the field, not retaining discipline and holding shape. Right,
yep.
These are things that professional footballers should know how to do. Whether you're attacking or defending, you defend with discipline, you defend with shape, regardless of how you're set up. I think part of the reason United are conceding these goals, I don't know if it would be fixed by asking players to be pragmatic, because I don't think they're capable. You go back to that Burnley game. Burnley hit the post in that game. They were a fraction within scoring. And if they score first, United probably don't score in that game. Right, so
yeah.
small margins
yeah.
make a big difference. If the Garnacho, yeah. you know, that shot that Garnacho hit, or the one that hits Mabry, goes in, we're talking about a different game, right?
Mm-hmm.
Small margins make a big difference. Marcus Rashford takes his chance at a different game. So I think with part of the problem is that when you constantly change your team like Ten Hag does, you get no rhythm,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
right? So this, I made this point last night, it's kind of like an orchestra constantly changing the musicians. The notes are the same, but the personality and the style of the musicians changing. But before you get that synchronicity, you have to get repetition.
Mm-hmm.
Solskjaer, Mourinho didn't have this much rotation. So they had essentially the same squad playing almost every week. So you could have, you know, you could work on that in training and say, okay, if we're in a game, we need to hold on to a lead. Let's do this.
Yeah.
United were able to do that last season. How many games did they win 1-0? Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, a lot of games 1-0. So Ten Hag's capable of asking his team to play that way. I just don't think with the team that he has, you know, he's got new issues in the dressing room with players that are unhappy. He's yeah. got players that don't really want to play for him, that he that has to do a job for him. You'll have players in that dressing room that are happy that United are losing because it reinforces their point that he's not the right guy. You have players being played out of position. And here's the thing, James, in my opinion, and I was asked this last season and I stand by this. if you need to have their best, strongest 11 on the team, they're probably the third best team in the Premier League. But if you go, once you start getting into United's squad, right, that squad is once you start getting into backup players, Bournemouth have a bigger budget than AC Milan. And once you get outside the top two teams in the Premier League, it's not a massive amount of difference until you really get to the bottom two, where you get maybe Luton and Sheffield United. They're probably a lot worse than everybody else. But everyone else in the middle, once you start getting to the squad players and injuries and players at a confidence, there's not a lot of difference. And we're judging teams based on their history. You know, Brighton haven't won a lot, but that's not commensurate with what you're seeing on the pitch. That once they're 11 starting against you, there's backup 11, not a lot of difference. And so
I think
these unrealistic expectations because it's Manchester United. Also do well to remember, Manchester United and Liverpool are the two most successful teams in England. Both of their successful periods across the 120-year history are summed into a very small part. Liverpool's most successful period came in the 70s and 80s. United's most successful period came under Sir Matt Busby and Sir Alex Ferguson. Outside of those two, it's been pretty much this. It's been the odd trophy here and there, maybe a third finish, a second finish, a sixth finish, a mid-table finish with relegation in there, right? So, you know, sustained success is really, really hard to do. Yeah. And so we shouldn't be surprised that sometimes these things happen. I'm not making excuses, but you know, I think that for Ten Hag, if United were to sack Ten Hag because of what we're seeing on the pitch, I think that's a major mistake.
Yeah, well, and I would agree with you, you know, in that respect, and to move on to kind of the further parts of these discussion, because there's a lot of things going wrong in this process. And one of the things that we've talked about before that I've said to you on here and that I maintain, because this goes back years, is that one of the biggest problems is, again, that you take any manager, any modern day manager, what are they really? They're a head coach. They're much more akin to an American style coach than they are to the managers of thinking about, you know, Jose back in the original days when he was younger, of Sir Alex Ferguson, of all these guys. That's not modern day management. They're head coaches. They're head coaches like you get in all the American sports. You have a general manager that runs the team, that organizes everything. And the head coach is the guy who sits on the training ground and teaches the players and coaches them and manages the in-game. And that is, you know, what the modern day management is about. That is what is successful. And it makes sense because the strength of the modern day is data. Is all the data that you're able to gather that you were not able to before due to, you know, everything that goes on. You have departments that can be built to understand everything, to monitor players down to this player needs to eat this, needs to run this much, needs to do this much. This is the schedule for them. That's what's going to make sure they have the most fitness on Saturday when that game kicks off for every single player, right? That is going to do the same thing in recruitment. That's going to do the same thing, you know, in health and recovery. It's going to do the same thing on everything. United don't have that. They don't have any of that set up the way that they should. They hired a data analytics head who's a well-respected person and are building it. This is a years and years, years long process. And right now it's only taking part in some areas. And you look at it and you can see some of the dividends of it paying off. You look at a player like Rasmus Højlund. I'll give this as an example. Rasmus Højlund and Mason Mount are two players identified by the club's analytics and recruitment department that is being built. And look at what they've done. They were easily the two best players for me last night, Mason Mount and Rasmus Højlund. You can see that Rasmus Højlund, despite being unproven, only having 9 goals in one season in his career, that is exactly the type of player that United should have been identifying for the last 10 years. And buying a player who has incredible physical tools and potential that they're not paying for with instant pressure, that they're already a star coming for a big paycheck. That's the type of player they should have been identifying and buying instead of the obvious for years and years and years. And, you know, these are the departments lacking. You stick any coach in there, they're going to fail. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer failed for the same reasons. Jose Mourinho failed for the same reasons. They all have their faults. Every one of them is going to have their faults. But you know, you take this example of fitness, and you know, this is a problem that Erik ten Hag is going to have to deal with in the locker room, because there's a lack of trust in him and his methods at the moment on this, which I know you want to touch on as well. But you take the fitness and injury issues that are going on right now. These cause players to lose confidence in their team, in their coach and the manager and all of that, when they're dropping left and right. Jose Mourinho wanted to run things a certain way, and he was allowed to. And that is different to how Erik ten Hag wants to run things. It's different to how Ole Gunnar Solskjaer wanted to run things. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer managed to have one of the best injury records as a manager for us, where for a couple of years during COVID, even with a busy schedule, we had most of our first team available for years. He was the only manager who was able to keep, you know, Anthony Martial healthy for the entire time. And you know what? He was absolutely destroyed for it by fans publicly for saying that he was training too lightly, which maybe he was. They had simple recovery sessions and basic work during the week. You take right now, you're getting the exact opposite with Erik ten Hag. It's heavy running every week. It's heavy in between games, and you have players getting injured left and right. You know, it's all symptomatic of the process being broken, where they don't know what the right answer is, and there's nobody to tell them these exact data-driven points. And so, agreed, you take any manager. I could look at Erik ten Hag right now and say, these results are worse than the results that got Jose and Ole sacked. They are, factually. They're worse. It's the worst start ever. I mean, it's in 1966 or something, right? It's the worst start for Manchester United in this period of time. It's worse than what got Ole Gunnar Solskjaer sacked. It's worse than what got Jose Mourinho sacked. And it's after spending a lot of money. However, what's the difference? You sack him, who do you hire? When they come in, what are they going to do? They're going to run into the exact same issues. You know, the manager at Bayern isn't going to have to be figuring out exactly how much running each player is going to have to do to stay fit and not get injured. The manager at Real Madrid is not going to do that. Pep Guardiola certainly doesn't have to do that. Arteta doesn't have to do that. Jurgen Klopp doesn't have to do that. None of them do. And any manager you bring in is going to run into these same problems. So it's a balance, because, you know, Erik ten Hag is making plenty of mistakes, but it's the type of thing where I'd say you take it out of his hands. And any manager that comes in is going to make those same mistakes unless they're perfect. And there's just, I don't know that that manager exists in modern day football. And that is the problem that it comes down to.
So I'm going to give my views on this. There are certain things that separate people. And they're usually subjective issues that are uniquely unique characteristics and distributed talents, where you see differential between human beings. Some people are really good at organization. Some people are really good at communication. Some people are really good at psychology, everything, right? United have always been a club that have been littered with injuries, even going back to Ferguson. Right, I remember Ferguson talking about these new Sony machines coming in that were going to change how United's injuries, or you know, they've always had this problem. Right, transcends Ten Hag. When Solskjaer came in, the first thing he said, "These players aren't fit." Right, first thing, and that in December is unacceptable. Why are they not fit? Ten Hag comes in after Brentford and makes them do all this running. And you see an immediate change. Now, when it comes to the fitness of an athlete, this is not Kentucky Fried Chicken. There's no secret recipe. There's no excuse for a professional sports outfit not knowing how to get a professional athlete fit. And I don't even think that's something that's uniquely the job of a manager. First of all, that's the job of the athlete, right? To make sure that they are doing the things that they need to do, to make sure that there's the integration where all the other metrics are intersectional. So you need to know body type, physiology. You need to know mental health, muscle group. You need to know all these things that are unique about an athlete in how to get them to optimal levels of fitness. Some things you can't change. Genetics, you can't change. There's some things where players are just injury prone and they're constantly going to pick up injuries no matter what you do. I don't think Anthony Martial is any Ten Hag's fault. This injury predate Ten Hag. And there's nothing he can do. He hasn't been fit essentially for 3 years, right? I don't think you can blame Ten Hag for Luke Shaw. I mean, these are guys that are all playing for the international teams too. So if United were asking him to do anything that's not consistent with what was going on at clubs previous or what was going on at their national teams and what have you, and they're asking him to do anything out of the norm, I think you would hear about that. You know, I've talked to players that play there, and I have never really heard much about methods, about intensity and everything. This is something that I think, you know, United are hiring people from other clubs that are doing exactly the same in other clubs. You know, so I accept that some of the injuries are absurd, but I also think that players have to take responsibility for their physical condition too. I think if you're constantly picking up non-contact injuries, then it costs a club an enormous amount of money to not have their players on the pitch. I don't think there wouldn't be a recalibration of certain fitness techniques to make sure that on an individual basis. I mean, you hear this all the time. You hear this player's away doing an individual program to get fit. This player's away doing it. They all have customized training programs based on these metrics that aren't a manager's job to know. These are the club's job to know. Right? Yeah. This is the club's job to turn around and say, this guy can't be trained this way. This guy can't be trained this way. This guy can't be trained this way. When Romelu Lukaku went to Italy, right, played under Solskjaer, first thing Antonio Conte said, he wasn't fit. Took him months to get him fit, right? And Lukaku said this himself when he went there, and I couldn't believe the difference in the intensity in Italy under Antonio Conte than what we were dealing with at United. So Mourinho would complain that United players weren't capable. I mean, come the end of the season, he's like, I got to pick this game. We got to prioritize this. Because we don't have the squad to be able to deal with that type of intensity. Ralf Rangnick said, United get injuries that nobody else gets. Why? Why is it that Liverpool, who are qualifying for the Champions League and have a lot more games than us, aren't getting the injuries that we're getting? Now, I remember I still have a copy of that interview. So these are issues that predate Ten Hag, right? So I can't say that this is a causal issue of Ten Hag's training when these are things that transcend him. So I don't know what the problem is. There's obviously things like Kobbie Mainoo, Ahmad, you can't blame him for those contact injuries. These things happen. I think part of it is United played more games than anyone else in Europe last season. With a relatively small squad of players that he trusts, right? So I think part of it is that. I think part of it is the fact that once you get out of United's first 11, the quality isn't good enough to rotate. And I think you get players that have played, you know, an awful lot that end up getting non-contact injuries. Wouldn't surprise me to see Dalo pick one up. Because look how much he's been playing. Rasmus Højlund, I think, was reading, that's his sixth game in like 20 days, right? I mean, because you know, don't have the option of rotating them, you know. Yep. So I think part of it is that, where other big squads, like, you know, that are competing on that level, I mean, Man City, all that, they have better quality to rotate. And I think United are always trying to. You know, when you hear Solskjaer getting three new signings each year, they're always trying to, we'll give you a strong 11, and anything after that has to be filled with players that, you know, nobody else wants, and young players that are coming through. And I think once you, like I said earlier, it's at that starting 11, they're pretty average. I mean, Van de Beek's coming on. You know, you couldn't find a club for Van de Beek, right?
Yeah.
I mean, David De Gea still can't find a football club, right? He's on a free transfer. So I don't know.
I don't know. Fred's winning the league in Turkey. They had some.
Yeah, with Turkey, before United signed them. No, how did he do? I mean, the Turkish league is. I mean, I was listening.
It's a funny league, though. It is.
I was listening to an interview. Who's the player? He played in Turkey. It wasn't Understanding. It was an Spurs player. I can't remember. And he played in Turkey, and you know, because he was talking about Veghorst, and they were asking him what's the difference, and he goes, Turkish league's probably top end, maybe mid championship, maybe almost.
Yeah, probably.
You know, you get some decent teams at the top, you know, but outside of that, I think, you know, it's totally different. But yeah,
yeah.
So anyway, but who knows? All right, let's evolve this conversation on me. Let me ask you a couple of other things. One, like we said earlier, the takeover stuff. There's another story put out by Kleinman this week about something we had talked about Jim Ratcliffe obviously changing his offer to potentially a minority buyout clause or minority stake. We had talked about the Glazers were trying to convince him to stay on the board and have control. What do you think? What are you hearing about this?
Yeah, well, let's take something under consideration here, which is that you and I both know, and people who've been watching us or following us for a while, that we do have quite good information on this.
Mm-hmm.
And when we heard that Ineos were in discussions again with Rayan and Glazers, it was quite a bit before these reports now. It took, I think, 12 or 13 days to come out, right? For Bloomberg to say that they were he was talking about restructuring the offer, and then for these details to start to come out on Monday. My initial look at the reports was to be extremely concerned, because I was worried about this, right? I mean, who wouldn't be? You and I have expressed a lot of opinions that I think we mostly agree on with regards to this takeover. We've never had a problem with Jim Ratcliffe taking over and the Glazers being minority shareholders who effectively can't do anything with the club. I've got no problem with it. I don't care. Whatever gets them out of control. A 25% stake in which Jim Ratcliffe is just one of seven voices is problematic. It's something I wouldn't be happy with. I would not support if that's the end of the process, right? If that is where it goes. There's no different to that than Ariel Investments or Elliott Group or any of those people coming in. I don't have a preference for Sir Jim Ratcliffe for that reason. I wouldn't say that's any better. If he would come in purely as a minority investor, it's the same as any of these other groups. I have there's no favoritism here. It has nothing to do with him. It's about the control. It's all about getting Glazers out of control. So my initial reaction to it was very, very concerned. But then I started to look into it a little bit more, and, you know, in speaking with our mutual friend who has, you know, stuff on this, we know that we'd heard pretty explicitly from him a few times that you wouldn't want to do this without control.
Yeah.
Right. It would be a massive, massive change in perspective for Jim Ratcliffe to abandon that and just go into it for no reason. And then I started thinking about the information that we heard and putting kind of the pieces together on this. Because what we were hearing was about voting rights and say and all of that. And I started realizing kind of a really simple point. If Sir Jim Ratcliffe's bid was for immediate majority ownership, there's nothing to discuss about voting rights. Because he's the majority owner, he would have by default the majority say in the club. So when we're hearing that the discussion is about voting rights, what I believe is going on, and this is going to be a tough sell if this is the case, but if the alternative is nothing, it is still the right outlook for the long run, is if the situation becomes where Jim Ratcliffe has to make a purchase for a minority stake with options over the next few years that will end up resulting in a majority takeover and eventually full control and full ownership. And the articles that came out didn't say that would not be happening. They just said they don't know. An article from Ducker at the Telegraph overnight was more indicating this is the route, that it would be the first step of a phased takeover, which I think is more likely. Then you have discussions about voting rights. Why? Because if you're buying something, even if you're only going to be the 25% owner at the moment, but in 2 years you plan to fully own it and you have those agreements in writing, wouldn't you want to have the say in the direction over those 2 years? You'd want to have a very large, if not significant or entire voice on it, because what if they make decisions that tank the value of this same asset in those, in that 2 year period? If you were to buy any business and you were buying it as a minority shareholder at the start, but with agreements to fully buy it out over the next 5 to 10 years, and some takeovers are done this way, you wouldn't want it to be entirely in the hands of somebody else, correct? It wouldn't make any sense.
Yeah, but I agree, right? I mean, you can't buy 25% of Class A shares and have no control over the direction, but all depends who has veto and all that.
Correct.
What I would say, James, is before I could lend my support to that, that would need a lot of clarification for me.
Correct, exactly 100%.
Yep. And what I would be concerned about is if the Glazers aren't willing to relinquish that control now, why would they be willing to do it in 3 years? And if they are willing to do it in 2-3 years in a phased buyout, why are they so determined to retain control? There's clearly a direction that they want to steer United in to make sure that happens. And an immediate, something in the immediate future that they see, which probably explains why they don't want to accept £5.5 billion bid, because they obviously see a cash grab in the near future. You know, there's talk about the Saudis investing heavily in the Club World Cup and turn it into a competitive Champions League tournament. I could definitely see that happening. I think if you look at where the obvious, direction that football will head in, it's going to be more and more globalized competition, right? So how can you expand on the allure of the Champions League to have a competition that has River Plate in it, that has Boca Juniors, that has, and of course it's great for the South American teams, they're having access to European revenue. And if I'm the Saudis and I'm saying I want a competition that's going to compete commercially and in terms of global, you know, marketing, it's essentially a club World Cup, you know, a replica of the World Cup, except in club form. And there's no question, in my opinion, that would be much more commercially lucrative. It would be certainly much easier to market. Imagine getting the US teams involved. Yep. You know, all of a sudden you've got LA Galaxy and all. I mean, that will, no question, cannibalize the Champions League. There's no doubt about that, right? And that I'm certain that will happen. What would concern me in a situation like that is it would become like the NFL, where there's no promotion relegation.
Yeah.
Once you get guaranteed revenue and there's no incentive to invest, you're stuck with these people for life. And they don't care if they finish bottom, because it's really, this is, of course, revealing exactly what their intention is with Manchester United and what their emotional attachment is to Manchester United. It has nothing to do with success. It has nothing to do with on-the-field success. For them, you know, utopia is a Manchester United that delivers cash without having to win, you know, because that removes, you know, they don't care about whether United win or not, they only care about whether it's successful or not. And of course, they don't like the fact that revenue is tied to on the field success, which is something they don't really care about. So I think that would concern me. Now, United may end up in that competition anyway under Jim Ratcliffe, it's possible. But for me, what people have to understand is, it's not just that United, I want rid of the Glazers. I want rid of the Glazer ideology. Anyone assisting them staying and running the football club in a way that's analogous to how they're running it right now with their ideology and their ethos, that's, you know, anathema to me. I don't want Jim Ratcliffe facilitating that. And we know that Jim is acutely aware of how United fans feel. And he's well informed on that. So he obviously knows that this is something that United fans desperately don't want. I think he wants United partly as a vanity project for his legacy. And I think that could be tainted very quickly if he's known as the guy that funded the Glazers then. And I completely agree. I would see no difference between that Carlyle Group, Sixth Street, or any investment company that said, here's minority investment, you can stay, and we will, you know, facilitate that. And so, you know, the idea that, you know, of preference for Jim Ratcliffe for some unknown reason, I've yet to identify. I'm not English.
I don't know.
I don't have a particular loyalty to Jim Ratcliffe based on something that I've yet to understand. I just want what's best for the football club, and You know, so if another buyer emerged that wasn't the petrochemical greenwashing guy that was, held himself to a high moral standard and wasn't a scumbag, I would support that individual.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you know, people do have to recognize this is an extremely complicated process, mm-hmm. this buying stuff. And part of the issue I've said is that if it were as simple as the Glazers would just sell to Qatar, then it would be done already. And that's my concern. And hey, maybe it will in the next week or so, like some people are claiming. I guess we'll find out in the next 7 to 10 days. I have my doubts that people have got one over on all these journalists who are very well informed. I mean, a guy like Kleiman at Sky is one of the best informed journalists on earth when it comes to financial dealings in Europe. He every day is, if you follow him on Twitter, is breaking stories that have nothing to do with football. The guy knows business and finance and is extremely well connected. I'd be very surprised if he didn't know what's going on here.
Most of the people in the business community, right, are under the impression that Sheikh Tassin will win that bid. I mean, if you listen to Bloomberg, David Hellyer was, I believe that Sheikh Tassin will win the bid for Manchester United. You go to the Reuters article, everything else. People that are informed in business that don't indulge in football speculation and their subscription isn't based on football speculation have all said the same thing. Now, I don't know if that's the case in that informed, but I mean, I would highly doubt if it was Sheikh Tassin what's going to get announced in the next 7 to 10 days. But in a slight defense of Neil Costas, he's not the only one saying that Sheikh Tassin will win this, and that seems to be the opinion, which is a well-informed opinion, that there's credible reason to believe that Sheikh Tassin will win that bid.
Right, and I think that comes down to the difference of an opinion that makes sense versus information that it's like all set and agreed, and that becomes the difference. I think there's very well-informed people who can logic it out and say it kind of makes sense, right? It's a straightforward deal. It's this and all of that. And the Jim Ratcliffe thing is complicated and is the problem. One of the problems with it, and one of the reasons he's probably going down this route that was detailed in that report, is if he's got to buy up some of those Class A shares, which are the publicly traded ones at the same price that he's offering the Glazers, then his purchase, which, and I won't bore you all with the math on this, but his purchase that initially might've been a cash outlay of 2.5, 2.6 billion, even at a valuation of 5.5 in order to get control of the club, becomes a cash outlay of 4 to 5 billion in cash. So that might be why it's looking at a different route in order to accomplish this. But at the end of the day, I don't believe it is just simply a minority offer for minority offer's sake, 25%, and that's it, and it's going to sit there. I think there's a lot more to this, but I'm not in support of it without access to the entirety of the detail on what it would mean. And it would absolutely have to, in the short term, lead to some change in control over the club. And in the long term, the complete takeover of it in general. It would have to. I could not support it any other way.
Okay, let's quickly wrap this up. We'll talk about Brentford at the weekend. Are we going to get to see our Danish star boy again, who... I have to say, watching that performance the other night, last night, reminded me a bit of Rooney against Fenerbahce when he was exceptional. He was very unlucky not to get a hat-trick. He led the line. Yep. He scored very different goals. Lovely header. The second goal really impressed me. The pace, the power to hold off the defender, to finish it with a delicate chip at full speed, all that's really, really difficult to do. And he's still only 20. Fantastic, fantastic young talent. I'm looking forward to seeing United at the weekend. Even though we're in a terrible run, what do you see at the weekend?
Yeah, I mean, me too. I think that if they could build on the positives that happened there, I think there are positives to build on. And you know, when I say, when we were talking about that point earlier about trusting the front group to get a goal, I think you can start to trust them to get a goal as Rashford starts to grow into the game. I don't think you should. I understand the mistake, but you know, as I was kind of saying before, I think you have to play Rashford into form.
Does he drop Onana?
No, I don't think he will.
So it's a question, does it help either if you drop him or do you keep him in there again, confidence?
I don't think it helps either of them, frankly. I'm not huge on dropping players for any reason except fitness, frankly, when it comes to confidence issues, if they have a proven track record for you. You know, I think Rashford has a proven track record as a goal scorer, the only proven track record as a goal scorer at our club. And you do a lot more playing him into form than lacking in confidence. I mean, maybe it takes some pressure off him, but I don't know. I don't see it. You're dumping the pressure then on Alejandro Garnacho to save you, which is in its own way unfair and difficult.
Okay, we will see. Quick score prediction for the weekend, my friend.
I'm going to go with 2-0. I think United will get it done this time.
I hope so. I hope so. All right, folks, don't forget, we'll be back on Monday of next week. And then in the near future, we'll start doing these lives. So we'll be taking questions and what have you. Don't forget, follow this guy at Muppeteers and subscribe to his platforms, YouTube, everything else. Same with my own Beyond the Pitch YouTube channel, podcast, or BTP Media on any major podcast platform. That's the best way you can support the show. We thank you for all of you who have done so far. Very much appreciated, and for all the kind feedback. James, take it easy, mate.
Thanks, you too. See you later.
See you guys. Bye.